Shrink Wrap Radio number 481, The Before and After of Couples Therapy with Marnie Feuerman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Marnie Feuerman, a licensed clinical social worker and licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in couples therapy in Boca Raton, Florida. For more information about Marnie Feuerman, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Marnie Feuerman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here, and we're going to be talking about couples therapy. But before we get into that, I see on your bio that you write for several prominent blog sites. Which ones are they, and how did that come about?
Well, I started out writing for YourTango.com, a love and relationship website. And I always liked writing, and I hadn't really done a lot of it because I was working in clinical practice and being, you know, working as a therapist in an office.
Sure.
But it's something that was always appealing to me, and I would be reading other blogs because there's so many now, you know, Huffington Post and, you know, that sort of thing. And,
yep.
And I thought to myself, hey, I can probably do this. And so I took a chance, and you can sign up for YourTango to have your blogs published there. And then from there, they can get syndicated to other websites. And so I was having a lot of success with that. So I guess I got that feedback that what I was writing was pretty good. People liked it. And then I got discovered, so to speak, by About.com. They were looking for somebody to write all their marriage content, and they reached out to me, and so then I became the marriage expert for About.com. And
yeah,
so that's
great. That sounds like a major hit.
Yes, it was wonderful. I love doing it, so it's worked out just great.
And then I saw something about the Oz, Dr. Oz website, that you're blogging there as well. Is that right?
Yes. I'm a little, I guess, out of sorts with that one because of being overwhelmed with a lot of writing, but I have published quite a bit on that site as well. And so I answer questions. People will type in a question in a search box, and usually it's obviously I'm focusing on relationship issues, mental health issues, and so you answer questions as an expert. And so, yes, I am publishing on that site as well.
Well, congratulations. Now, I see you live in Boca Raton, Florida. Have you been affected by any of the recent big weather changes?
Well, I would say good ones, so not bad ones. We're coming into our season here now, and so the weather is beautiful. We kind of suffer through really hot summers, and then this time of year, like October through about April, May, is just beautiful. So it's been very nice down here. And then we've also come out of hurricane season. We're coming out the end of this month, and so we all kind of are very relieved when we haven't been hit by any hurricanes.
Oh, lucky you. Yeah, other parts of the country are really suffering. Texas and adjacent states have just been flooded like crazy.
Yes, we can empathize because we've had plenty of it.
Yeah, you've been there years past, huh?
So it's good if you don't get it, but we don't wish it on anyone else either.
Right. So what drew you to working with couples?
That's an interesting question, because I think with a lot of therapists, whatever they're doing and the population they're working with, a lot of times we feel like it's picked us in a way. And I would say, you know, I liked mental health issues, and I worked a lot doing individual therapy. And when I would have experiences with couples or families, it just felt like more of a challenge to me. And it was also fascinating. It just sort of took the work to a new level. It was just something new to learn. And then, you know, as I'm kind of thinking about it, I guess I really fell into it and liked doing it, probably because of my own personal experiences growing up, coming from a divorced family and how that's affected me and my life. And so I would say helping couples and helping marriages stay together just really fit and seemed like I had a sense of purpose for doing it, probably because of what I had been through.
Yeah. So if you don't mind my getting personal, how did the divorce of your parents affect you? How old were you? And, you know, because partly I'm wondering, the context of my question is the whole question of whether it's better for parents to stay together for the kids or not. So tell us your story.
Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, if we can answer that question, it would be great if we had an ideal answer to it. And I think there's just a lot of variation, and it just, there's a lot of variables in answering that. But for me, you know, I was a teenager, and I think, you know, I think it was more of a sudden not see it coming type of situation, which actually I've heard maybe, you know, worse for people than if they kids are growing up around some conflict. They kind of expect it. They see it coming, and maybe a little bit different than the unexpected version.
Yeah.
I think just your world completely changes. The world as you know it becomes completely different. And I would say the hardest part is just people's just difficult feelings around it. You know, you have an event or a holiday, it's completely changed. You have people who don't want to be around each other, people who are hurt by somebody. Just a big division occurs in the family. And so I just think emotionally it's really, really difficult, really hard. So I'd say that's, you know, my experience of it happening, you know, as a teenager. And again, there's another variable with if someone has it happen to them and they're very young and they grow up and that's all they know. So that's a little bit of a different experience for people.
Yeah.
It's sort of flipping things upside down, you know, in your life.
Yeah. Now, you did mention that you found couples therapy more challenging than one-to-one. And so you must, you evidently you're a person who likes to take on challenges. And I certainly agree with you about that. But what do you find to be more challenging about working with couples or families?
The dynamics are really, really different. You have to be careful to not align with somebody. So if you have
right.
two people in a room, you don't want to feel like you're taking sides. You know, you have to maintain more of a neutrality. I mean, that's not 100% of the time, but you use it quite sparingly. And when you're with somebody individually, you can really empathize and with them and be really drawn into them and their experience. And so, but you have two people in the room and they have completely different perceptions, a different way of experiencing a situation. And you don't want to make someone feel like they're right or wrong. You just want to help those two people negotiate it together or work it out together. And so it's just a very different way of working that you wouldn't do when you're with somebody one-on-one.
Yeah, and to me that just seems like a very big challenge because I think it's a very human thing to take one side or the other. And so you have to resist that pull.
Yes, exactly. So you do have to resist that, and then you have to help them try to see each other's perspectives as opposed to you saying, which you can easily say right away when you have one person in front of you, you can express how you understand their perception quite easily. And so you really do that sometimes for both people, but you try not to alienate the other person when you are trying to show that you validate one of their perspectives. So it's a delicate balance that you're really doing throughout the whole process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we read and hear so much about the changing structure of families in the United States and maybe elsewhere in the world. So I'm wondering, in your practice, do you see atypical kinds of couples, for example, gay couples or families that are, you know, have kids from different sources, et cetera?
Yeah.
All the variations. Any of that happen in your practice?
Sure. I mean, not as much as maybe people think. And I think part of that is that therapists have really started niche practices. And so there are definitely people who specialize in same-sex relationships or specialize in working with blended families, step-parents, things like that. Sure, I can get definitely a broad mix, but I would say it's probably the more traditional couple that is, you know, married however long and just running into distress and difficulties that they can't seem to solve on their own. But yes, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on out there because of remarriages, kids from prior marriages living together in a household. And again, all of those things can just present more challenges for a couple and more difficulty for them in trying to problem solve and figure things out.
Sure. And speaking of the state of marriage, is the divorce rate still hovering around 50%, or has that changed?
Overall, it is still around 50%. If you look at first time marriages, it's in the low 40s, so the low 40% or so. But it's about 50% if you take into consideration second and third marriages. Because for second marriages, it's around 60%, third marriage is 70%. So it just...
I'm shocked to hear that. I would have thought that it would be just the opposite, that that having gone through a divorce and discovered how painful that can be, that people would work harder at sticking in their subsequent relationships.
I know. You think it would be, but truthfully, the if you've been married before, you're more likely, if you've already been divorced, you're more likely to get divorced. And I think people, either they haven't learned from the divorce, they haven't learned what they did wrong, or like what we touched on before, they're bringing in more complications. So if you bring in you two have a baby together, plus you have your kids from the previous marriages, and then you're all together, again, that just creates more challenges, and that's what's usually going on in second and third marriages.
And who's more likely to initiate the divorce, the husband or the wife?
It's usually the wife. That's what we're seeing. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. If you look at, over time, over history, women now are, they're more empowered economically, socially, educationally. And so maybe 50, 60 years ago, they didn't have the resources to necessarily just go get a lawyer and get divorced. But now they have more resources to do that. There's less of a stigma because there's so much divorce going on around them. And of course, there's the underlying reasons that women are doing this, which is interesting to talk about. I think, men become more complacent because their lifestyle is going to change a lot more drastically if they get divorced. So they're less likely to leave. It's the women who are cooking, cleaning, picking up the lawn, getting the dry cleaning, doing the child care. So they're doing a lot of the caretaking type responsibilities. And so they can get just emotionally fed up with that. Whereas the men sort of have their routine and the women are taking care of a lot of these things. And so the women value, not that men don't value connection, but women value the connection and the relational issues a lot more in the relationship. They want to spend time with their husbands. They start, they start nagging them for that. And if they don't get that, you know, they start thinking, well, they start planning their exit strategy, so to speak. So it's important for, I think, the men to know this and to know that if they hear the nagging and complaining, although that's not the best strategy, I think, that the women are using, they should look at it as, you know, I really have to hear, have to listen. My wife wants to spend time with me, or my wife really, you know, needs to hear what's going on in my head. I can't just keep it to myself, because women will start to get, you know, they'll start to check out and detach when that starts to happen.
Uh-huh. Interesting. And it sounds like the traditional role structures are still pretty much in place, even though we hear about how that's changing and shifting and men are more involved with, you know, at least younger men are more involved with child care and taking on some of the household tasks.
Right. I mean, it's definitely changed, but you're right. We still tend to fall into more traditional type roles once we get married. So, so that's, you know, there's some definitely some truth to that. But I would say if you asked women, if you polled women, they would be telling you they're doing more of the household responsibilities, the child care, the cleaning, the cooking, and those types of traditional things that they've always done.
Yeah, yeah. So you've mentioned some of the problems. Are there other sort of common problems between couples that you see in your practice?
Sure. They come in with, you know, I'll kind of go through maybe several different things that I commonly see.
Good.
Sometimes they just seem disconnected, like they feel as if they don't have anything in common anymore, or there's a lack of, like a physical or an emotional connection. Sometimes they just have high conflict arguments, or they don't feel like they can communicate well with each other. I tend to see it a lot as vicious cycles of communication. They get into these patterns. You know, we have one person who typically pursues for the connection and pursues for this communication, and we have another person who might typically shut down or avoid or be dismissive. And so we like to look at some of these patterns so that we can help them change those underlying dynamics so that they can communicate more effectively with each other.
Yeah.
And then other times it's just, they just are experiencing something really stressful. It could be stressful out of the ordinary. Somebody gets ill or goes through some type of a disability, or they have a sudden financial change. They lose a lot of money or have to file bankruptcy. Things like that really can throw a huge amount of stress into a marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how does a person know when it's time to seek help?
Well, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
I think it's hard for people to know when they're in it, and it either becomes their norm, you know, their normal way of interacting, or they just avoid or deny that there's a problem. But somebody should definitely seek help if they start to feel that they are disconnected with their partners, or they are getting into distress and arguments that they can't seem to get out of. And certainly if a major stressor has come into their lives, that's also a good idea to seek help.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking men often I'll venture to say often feel at a disadvantage in couples therapy, that women tend to be more in touch with their feelings or more comfortable talking about their feelings. And so there's a real risk of the man just coming into it and feeling at a disadvantage and like he's going to be beat up. What's your thoughts about that?
You know what, you're right to a large extent. Women are better at it, more in touch with their feelings. You know, we've been socialized that way, so naturally it's easier for us, and I think men do fear the process because of that. And I think a big part of it is probably the therapist and how they handle something like that. So I like to normalize that experience. Like if a man is having difficulty articulating what he's feeling inside. I just work with what he's giving me and try to help him with that and make those connections. And sometimes it's about educating him and also educating the wife so that she understands that he may not be at the same emotional level. You know, his ability to articulate his emotions may not be the same as hers. And that maybe it's about her being more patient and also giving credit for the little efforts that he's doing. If he never expresses himself in that way and he's starting to, she's got to, you know, help him with that as well. So two people kind of have to help each other in that regard. But I think, you know, I think you're right. And it's unfortunate if men are scared of it for that reason. But it makes sense that they're scared of it because it is harder for them.
Yeah. And also, there are two women now in the room.
Yes. Or you get that circumstance. Sure. Sometimes you have two people who both have difficulty expressing themselves emotionally, you know, whether it's two men or a man and a woman. And then what the problem is, you know, they're the ones that kind of become roommates, you know. They wake up one day after being together 10, 15 years, and they just don't feel like there's a lot between them. Or they have kids, and the kids leave the house. And then they realize there just hasn't been a whole lot of emotional energy between them.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a problem, too, of course.
Yeah. So can we talk about the kinds of interventions or techniques that you found to be helpful with couples?
Sure. You know, like I mentioned before, changing the negative patterns is something that we do. And one of the techniques or one of the interventions I like to do is to help the couple see that pattern between them as the common enemy so that they're not just blaming each other.
Mm.
So a piece of that is getting them to express an underlying emotion. And that means expressing what's underneath a reactive emotion or what the partner's seeing. A typical example is they get very angry and they escalate in anger, but really underneath they're hurt or they're sad or they feel lonely or they feel unimportant. And most of us can respond much easier when we hear that. When you hear your partner say, you know, I'm feeling really lonely and I miss you, is quite different than yelling at somebody saying, you never spend any time with me.
Yeah.
You know, those come across so differently.
Right.
And so we help teach people how to speak on that level with each other so it pulls their partners in as opposed to pushing them away with the reactive type of behaviors and feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there a particular theoretical approach that that you're married to, quotes?
Well, there's definitely a few approaches that can really offer a lot to couples. But one of the ones that I find a lot of success with and that I really like is emotionally focused therapy. And this was developed by Dr. Sue Johnson. And it's what I just described to you. You know, some of the interventions are doing what I just talked about. And also, it has an attachment theory foundation, which just what that is how we approach the couples are looking at their attachment history. So what kind of relationships they had with their parents and primary caretakers early on, because that's what has established their sense of safety and security in relating to people. So it carries on to their adult romantic relationships. And so sometimes people do very typical things that are really self-protective. For example, if they're shutting down when conflict arises, they're shutting down because they've probably had very negative experiences around conflict. They're not used to, you know, two people maybe yelling and having it out, and then they're done and they hug and kiss and that's that. It's done. You know, they've maybe have had very bad experiences, and so they will do very typical things that they've always done that help them cope. But then we find that they don't work so well anymore. So they get into an adult romantic relationship, and then when they shut down, when their partner is upset about something, that drives them crazy, and it makes things worse. And so we look at how these things are really connected, throughout their lives and how they've been relating to people throughout their lives.
Yeah, attachment theory just keeps coming up in so many of the interviews that I'm doing these days. It's just, it's become so mainstream to look at attachment patterns, and it's also being fused with our understanding of the brain. So it's kind of exciting to see this theoretical development that is being so widely embraced and that makes such sense.
Yes, attachment, like you said, neuroscience. This is all great stuff, and it's very research-based, so there's a lot of good studies out now that that really show that it's important, and it's good for people to learn. It could be complicated, though, but I would say if people can get their hands on some material that's easy for them to digest, because it's not like too clinical, people can really learn a lot that could be helpful for them in their own relationships.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. And by the way, I think I interviewed Sue Johnson some time back. I've interviewed so many people now that I'm starting to get a little fuzzy, but I'm pretty sure I did interview her. And so what about sex?
She's done some fascinating and very solid work, and she's put it into a way to teach clinicians, teach therapists how to do it. And that's great too. So it's not just a theory, it's a theory that's very practical so that therapists can work with clients and really help them in their relationships.
Yeah. And I'm curious too, in terms of your own training and getting involved in family therapy, I see you are both a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed marriage family therapist. I'm assuming that the social work came first, is that right?
Yes. I have a master's in social work, and then I got my licensure. And a little bit after that, I applied for what's called dual licensure. And in my state, they have that as an option. If you've been in practice a certain amount of years and then you take the exam, you can become dually licensed. And so that's what I did. Because like I said, I wanted to work with couples, and I felt like it was important to get their credentials as well.
Yeah. And had you started in the couples direction in your social work program, or did that come later?
That came later. One of my first jobs was on a psychiatric unit, so it was very intense also.
Yeah.
So I worked with some very hardcore mental health issues. But I would say it was a great training experience. It's a great foundation because I think if you start with this really hard stuff, the other stuff that you're going to do doesn't seem as hard. So I worked with some people who had very serious social issues as well, and some of them even had medical problems. So they could have had clinical depression and chronic pain, and they were on the verge of homelessness, and so some really tough things. So it sort of evolved from there. And then when I went into private practice, which is quite different, you're dealing with people who are definitely higher functioning. They have more resources, or maybe more educated. I think one of the problems that I hope we can address at some point is being able to help couples who don't have the resources. They may not be able to pay $200 an hour for the best therapist. So I would love to see it something where there's maybe programs and resources out there to help people of all economic levels. I think that would be something great. We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. Now, in the work that you do, how often is sex the presenting issue or underlying issue?
It does come up a lot. What I'm finding is sometimes people don't necessarily come in, or they're not going to call you and say it's a sexual problem. That doesn't happen a whole lot. Usually they come in and they're talking about many other things, and when you do your assessment and you're asking all your questions, often there's a sexual issue as well, and it could be a number of things. in part, it could be that they're so disconnected, and often it's the wife that really pulls away sexually. And so then that also plays into a negative cycle of communication between them, because then the husband feels, you know, rejected and upset and hurt, and he doesn't feel loved. But the woman will say, well, I don't feel like having sex with you because you come home and you go right to your computer and you don't talk to me. And so then they're kind of going through that dance over and over. And I know I'm talking a bit stereotypes here, but it can go in different directions. I mean, I've definitely seen it where the woman has more of a desire for sex than the man, whether it's his sex drive, is just lower. And that's a common thing. It's the sex drives are not the same, and not that that's very common, so that's not unusual. I think if it becomes a problem is when they can't negotiate around it and they can't figure out what's the balance so that they're both reasonably happy with that. So that's a big piece of what we start to see, but usually it's uncovered when you're peeling back what's going on in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the man going to his computer, and so that kind of raises the issue of pornography. And, you know, what's been your observation and experience with the role of pornography in the couple's work that you're doing?
I think it depends on the couple. I mean, some couples will enjoy porn together, and it's part of their relationship and they have fun with it. I think where it becomes a problem is if there's a lack of intimacy and sex in the relationship. So if the person is strictly just looking at porn and ignoring his partner and not having sex with them, and then it's definitely an issue. And I think it just depends on, you know, the attitude of the people in the relationship. I think if it gets to a point of it being an addiction, obviously that's a big problem and it's not going to bode well for the relationship. And sometimes people don't know, they don't know it's an addiction yet. There's just like a lot of addictions that they're in denial or they don't realize it's a problem. And that usually takes going to a professional and someone that deals with that type of a problem, deals with sex addiction or porn addiction. And often the partner can be instrumental in helping with that as well, because they're going to want to do sessions together. They're going to want to have sessions one-on-one with the person who's got the problem. So it's a whole mix of things. And it's something that I do hear on occasion. But again, it's something that I think people get very embarrassed about or ashamed about. So sometimes it's not uncovered until they come in and they might say, I'm just having problems. I'm just having problems in my relationship. And then once you ask the questions, you find out that it could be something related to a porn addiction.
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of shades into the issue of infidelity. Tell us about that. What's the difference between, I guess, you know, the porn could be considered maybe an emotional infidelity of sorts, or it's often perceived that way, right?
Right. So infidelity is definitely a major issue that comes up, and that will sometimes bring somebody into the therapy. Even if there's problems going on for a while, they won't come into therapy until someone's been caught cheating. And there is emotional and there's physical, and sometimes people will get into, you know, the labels and the semantics of it and argue over that, and that's not helpful. I think physical, we know, look, if you had physical contact, if you touch someone, if you kiss someone, it probably could be considered like a physical form of infidelity. But I'd rather people just look at it as that there were secrets going on between the two people, and that somebody kept something from their partner, whether it's this friendship that turned really deep and emotional, or somebody's hiding the fact that they're on the computer looking at porn for hours. If you're hiding it, if you're secretive, if there's a third party involved, be it a computer or another person, these are all serious problems. that you'll need help for. So I try not to get too caught up in the labeling of it, because they really do have to figure out, you know, what's happening in the relationship that somebody's going outside of it or doing these things.
Yeah, sometimes what happens, because of confidences that have been shared with me, is that somebody will meet somebody online and develop a really deep emotional connection. Not that it's ever acted on physically, but you know, but that would be a kind of infidelity, as you're saying, because it's secretive. Or if it's
right,
not
it's
secretive,
secretive.
Jealousy is likely to happen anyway.
Right, and it takes something away from your relationship with your partner. It makes you're not going to not have like a skewed vision of your partner at some point when this other person's in your life. It will start to affect the way you're seeing your marriage, your relationship, your partner. And I think people downplay that. They think that's not true, but I think they're lying to themselves if they think, oh, my feelings for this other person have nothing to do with the way I feel about my wife or my husband. So it's just not realistic.
And do people come back from infidelity? I mean, that's generally considered such a major wound. Can couples therapy really help people recover from that?
It can, but I won't say that it's easy. It's definitely a more challenging type of issue to deal with couples. I think there's things that make somebody more successful or a couple more successful at overcoming this.
Like what?
I think the level of remorse is a big piece of it. So if the person that had the affair is really showing remorse, I think if they both want to get an understanding of the underlying problems in the relationship that maybe led someone to make a decision to cheat, I think if they can explore that and not just blame and not just say, oh, it's your fault, you cheated, that's it. You know, I think they have to look at what happened before the person decided to do that. I think if they're motivated, if they really commit to having professional help, all those things are definitely going to make the outcome better or give the couple the best possible chance of having a good outcome.
Do you have an example from your own practice that you could share with us where the couple successfully overcame infidelity?
Sure. There's a couple that I was seeing that, well, let me tell you what they've been doing. So, which I give them a whole lot of credit for, is that they are doing treatment together with me in couples therapy, and then they both also see their own individual therapist. So they're working on themselves as well as the relationship.
Mm.
Another thing that they, you know, and of course the person that did the cheating, he was very remorseful and he really did feel bad and he really wanted to make changes in himself. And I think there was like a sense of shame around what he did. And he really let himself feel it and he expressed it. So this way his partner could see, that he really felt bad about what he had done. And I think that kind of told her, oh, and I can, you know, probably trust him again. If he feels so bad, it's unlikely that he would do this again, because she could really see how it was affecting him, his decision to do that. The other thing is that they didn't just stop coming when things got better, because slide backs are very normal. So they kept in check, even if it wasn't coming in weekly, they would still come in, whether it be every 3 or 4 weeks or so, to do their check-in, make sure they were on track. If something happened, they could process it. And so I would say it was just the overall commitment to doing everything they could to get their marriage back on track. And I think they also wanted to, because they had children, which shouldn't, I know, be the only reason, but I think it's a really good reason, because then again, you're affecting your kids if you're splitting the family up. So I think that was also a motivating factor, is to keep the family together, but also to be happy and make the changes that they needed so that their relationship was really solid.
Okay. What are some of the ways that couples get marriage wrong or right?
Well, I like to talk about John Gottman with this because he's a great marriage researcher. He's done some of the best work with couples to kind of see, you know, what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong. And he termed it masters and disasters of marriage, which I love that term. And so the people who get it wrong, what he's noticed are several negative patterns of communication that predict divorce. And I'll talk about each one briefly. We have criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And what criticism is this is when you state your complaint about your partner, you're focusing on a defect about their personality. So rather than saying, you know, I'd like for you to clean up more, you say something like, you're such a slob, or you're lazy. So you're really giving a harsh criticism. And that, he notices, is really bad in a relationship. And then there's contempt. And this is probably one of the worst ones. And this is where somebody, there's almost like a sense that they're superior to their partners. And they can be even belligerent at times. Maybe they're even calling them names or being somewhat abusive or outright abusive in a way, verbally. And they roll their eyes at everything the person says.
Yeah, that's one. I remember reading that and the eye rolling. Yeah. That really stuck with me.
And sometimes we, you know, we see that, and I'd say it's like you feel like your heart's sinking because it's really rough to deal with a couple where one or both of them have that contempt in their relationship.
Yeah.
And defensiveness is somebody is very, very self-protective, but it's sort of in a very self-righteous way. They won't really see or admit to their own flaws at all. They'll just immediately say, it's not my fault, it's you, I didn't do anything wrong. They over-explain, they want to justify what they're doing. So they just immediately get defensive when their partner brings something up and they don't want to see what their piece could be in it. And then stonewalling is just emotional withdrawing from the interaction, refusing to talk, giving the silent treatment, just not wanting to engage in, like if your partner brings up wanting to discuss something and the person just refuses to talk about it. So those four things are really bad signs in a relationship, and they definitely predict divorce when we see them. But we have to see it to a certain extent. You know, everybody has it a little bit, you know, so if people are listening and they're thinking to themselves, well, I do a little bit of this or I do a little bit of that, you know, that's okay because everybody does. It's when it's pervasive, or when, you know, one of them or one of these particular patterns is just happening so frequently that the interactions become, you know, more distressing than positive, and then the distressing ones outnumber the positive ones, and that's when it becomes pretty bad. But of course we have, on the other hand, the masters or the people who get it right, and we notice that people sort of, they act like they're friends with each other. There is a mutual respect. There's emotional engagement and responsiveness. You can see that they really have each other's backs and they really care about each other. They know how to compromise and negotiate. They also seek novelty with each other. They go out together. They do activities. They have new experiences together. They don't just kind of get in a rut and a routine and, you know, and that's that. So we can definitely see that there's things that couples can do to really have a fantastic, thriving relationship. And some of them, you know, do things to just create a horrible relationship between the two of them.
It's too bad we don't have classes in school or something along the way to get young people alerted to some of these things.
Yeah, there are. In fact, Gottman does have some classes. I know he has one particularly for when a couple is going to have a baby, like bringing baby home. And then there are premarital counseling courses that are quite good. There's a couple of them that really cover a lot of good information. I think, you know, it's probably more about people not wanting to have maybe their bubble burst. Yeah. So they're not maybe seeking these services.
Right.
But I would love for it to be mandatory for people, you know, when they're engaged. I think it would be fantastic. So, yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah. What about any treatment options or resources for people who are kind of on the borderline, maybe considering divorce?
Well, we have something that's been developed over the last few years. I don't think there's been a lot before this, because I think a lot of the resources out there are either very pro-marriage or very pro-divorce. It's kind of hard to find things in the middle where somebody isn't sure or they're contemplating divorce. So there is something, it's called discernment counseling. And these are for people who maybe the two of them aren't sure if they want to get divorced, or one person is considering divorce. And so they have different agendas. They're starting off in different places. So traditional couples or marriage therapy tends to stall out with these people because their goals are different. And so this is a way to work with them where they have a session where they both come in together in the beginning, but then, like, let's say the first part of the session, and then they're worked with separately, and then they're brought back together again. And it's a pretty standard protocol for how to work with these people. And then each session, if they want more, it's decided at the end of that session. They may only want one session. They may feel like they need more. And it's to help them gain clarity and confidence about how to move forward, because there's really three paths to explore. They look at, do we go back to just staying the same and doing what we're doing? The second path is move towards separation and divorce. And the third path would be all out 6-month commitment to reconciliation and marriage therapy, with a full commitment to that process. And it also involves educating them about what those different paths look like, and asking them certain questions so that they can really figure out, you know, what they want to do and the impact it's going to be on their lives, because it's such a critical decision. And so that's been a really good resource for people, and I would say it's something that is still being disseminated to people, because it's you know, like I said, it's something that's just been around a couple of years. There's also formats to help clergy and lawyers, because these people show up into those offices as well. They're not always showing up at a therapist's office.
Right.
So it's fantastic information.
It sounds like it might be research-based from the way you're putting it.
It is. It's from Dr. Bill Dougherty. He's the one who developed the program out of Minnesota, uh-huh. Couples on the Brink Project. And what I think he did was he started to work with couples in this situation. And then from there, the research grew out of what he was seeing. So he saw that there was a need for this, and so he worked with many, many couples and developed and refined the protocol over time, and then did the research. And I think he's recently published, within the last couple months, he's published some studies about what he's found.
Mm-hmm. Now, you may have covered this already, but what are the best ways for couples to stay connected?
I would say first thing is really talking to each other, saying how you feel, saying what's on your mind. It's when you don't talk or you don't discuss, you know, what's going on inside emotionally and how you feel about things, that you're not going to develop closeness. It's not how it happens. And even, you know, even a friendship, we wouldn't become friends with people if we didn't hear about their highs and lows, their ups and downs, what they like, what they don't like. So we can't forget to do that because we're married, or because we've been together a really long time. So I think you really have to show up for each other in that way and do new things together. Like I said, novelty is really good. Have physical affection, you know, whether it's sex or just hugs and holding hands or whatever it is. It's whatever the two people together feel like they need. When it's really out of whack and two people desire different levels of it, it can cause some difficulties. But again, like I've said, you talk about it and you negotiate it. And if somebody says it's really important for me to have more affection, then, you know, you may not be as comfortable doing it, but you still have to step up and get out of your comfort zone a little bit for it to become more comfortable. And then you see your partner reacting positively to it. It's going to make you want to do it more. So sometimes it takes stepping out of your comfort zone. And I think couples can stay connected primarily in those ways. And I think if they make the effort to and they put their relationship first, they will do that. They will find a way to stay connected to each other.
Okay. Well, how about your own career? Somehow, with the ambitious blogging that you're doing and so on, I have the sense that you might have other ambitions. Where do you see your work going in the future?
Well, I'm in the middle of getting my doctorate in clinical psychology, so about halfway through.
Good for you.
Probably some published research would be great, of course, in couples work. I would love to write a book at some point, but I don't know when. You know, I'm thinking maybe turning some of the blogs into a book or expanding on some of the blogs I have would be a good option. I like doing training, so I like helping other therapists become couples therapists. That's very rewarding for me to do. And then just keep helping couples, whether it's seeing them in my office and working with them directly or imparting this information online through the blogging. Because what I think is really nice is that, you know, if you feel it's difficult to reach out to a therapist or go see one and talk to one, there's literally a lot of information at your fingertips. I mean, you'll want to make sure you find the good information and go to reputable sources and websites, but it is there, and there's a lot of really good stuff online you can read about that can also be helpful to your relationship.
Now, do you hear back from people on your blogs?
Yeah, sometimes I do. If it's posted on social media, sometimes people can comment on them. Sometimes people will directly email me. So I've definitely gotten some information from people reaching out or wanting to know where to go to get some help, or they'll just ask a question. You know, I do what I can within reason, but at the very least, I like to direct them to where they can get good local resources. So if I can direct them to getting the help that they need, I feel like, you know, I feel really good about doing that.
Yeah, great. Well, look, as we wind down now, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that I've really enjoyed talking to you about couples therapy. And if anybody wants more information or if they want to read some of my blogs, they can go to www.marriage.about.com. Or my personal website is www.thetalkingsolution.com. They can sign up for newsletters on both those sites so they can get the information fairly regularly if they're interested.
That's great. You've got nice, easy to remember URLs there.
Yes, that's what I try to do because my last name gets butchered most of the time.
Yeah.
So I thought that'd be too difficult for people to type in. So I wanted to set, like, have something that sounded a little bit easier and catchier.
Yeah. Well, Marnie Feuerman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed and learned from this report from the trenches with family therapist Marnie Feuerman. My hat is off to her for both being able to meet the challenges of working with more than one client at a time and with the way she is disseminating her knowledge and advice on her various blogs. She mentioned two major influences on her approach to working with couples. One was Dr. Sue Johnson, whom I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 385, The Science of Romantic Relationships. If this is a topic of particular interest to you, you might want to go back and listen to that interview. The other person of major influence she mentioned is Dr. John Gottman. I thought I had him lined up for an interview sometime back, but somehow that never quite materialized. However, I've just recently lined up his wife, Dr. Julie Gottman, who is the co-author of their latest book, 10 Principles for Doing Effective Couples Therapy. If all goes well, that interview will be released on or around December 3rd of 2015. The title of the Gottman's book, again, is 10 Principles for Doing Effective Couples Therapy. And if you'd like to read it before my interview, you can use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar of our site. And by using that widget, you'll also be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Hackett, and I'm an accredited psychotherapist based in Dublin, Ireland. I'm delighted to mention that I've just become a jumbo contributor to Shrink Wrap Radio. Having really enjoyed the show for over a year now, I've found that Dr. Dave's interviews and his gentle reflections at the end of each has often left me feeling a renewed sense of passion and enthusiasm in my work, a sense of excitement in being part of a wider community of therapists and mental health professionals, and personally enriched by virtue of the themes and ideas presented in the show pertinent to my own development as both a person and a practitioner. I hope my small monthly contribution demonstrates my gratitude to Dr. Dave for his commitment to forging connections in and amongst us all. Should you wish to express your gratitude, I would encourage you to visit the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click the support button to keep Shrink Wrap Radio in our lives for many years to come.
Thank you, Mike Hackett. It's wonderful to receive such strong support from a fellow professional there on the Emerald Isle. Thanks for encouraging others to join you. I also want to say thanks to all of you out there who have been supporting Shrink Wrap Radio. As I've mentioned before, my heart is filled with gratitude every time I go into PayPal and see the names of my ongoing and new donors. Thank you all so much. Your faith and steadfastness are what keeps me going. We do have one new donor on our honor roll since last time, and that's Nadia Gomez. Thank you, Nadia. By the way, I'm happy to announce a new transcript on the site thanks to Gloria Ullman in Australia. It's number 478, opening to Spirit Mediumship with Suzanne Maiden, M.A. Gloria jumped right on this one. I think she set a new record for speed of getting a transcript out right after an interview. And by the way, holistic psychiatrist and psychopharmacologist Dr. Hedaya, former guest on the show, has the herbal pain relief product Unflame that I've been advertising in our right-hand sidebar. You can get $5 off by using my discount code of UNFL1815 when you call direct at 619-500-4372. Once again, let me remind you to go to the survey tab on our site, if you haven't done so, to take the updated survey. And once again, let me remind you about my CE courses that are offered through the Zur Institute. I have over 100 units there, and you can get them at a 10% discount by using my discount code of DrDave88. That's DrDave88. But wait, there's more. Not only can you get a discount on my courses, but also any of their other 170 courses and private practice materials. Just go to zurinstitute.com to explore their very voluminous site and use my discount code of DrDave88. And by the way, all their courses and materials are APA approved. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, which I've repeatedly noted is my favorite audiobook service, I have another great recommendation today. Again, it's a terrific follow-on to today's interview on couples therapy. Back in 2008, I interviewed Dr. Stan Tatkin, who struck me at the time as one of the most effective couples therapists out there. Well, it turns out he has a couple of books on Audible.com. And the one I'm recommending is titled Your Brain on Love, The Neurobiology of Healthy Relationships. It's by Dr. Stan Tatkin and also narrated by him. So you'll get practically 6 hours of solid education that will help you in your own couple's relationship. Let me play you a little sample.
Relationships are lasting longer because we're lasting longer. People are much older. Nobody really intended relationships to last this long because people died at age 30, maybe earlier than that. So this is an experiment in some ways. How are you going to do it? A lot of people think of their relationships from courtship, and they want to go back to the time of courtship, and that's always a mistake because courtship, like I said, is a different animal. There's no going back to that. You're not the same people in courtship. You're not even really yourselves in courtship. So why go back to that? But a lot of people are really enamored by the idea of being attracted to their partner. They're attracted physically. Or they have so much in common. We really love the same things. Or we think the same things. We have the same attitudes. And you have to ask yourself, how long is that going to last? It's not going to last very long. That phenomenon is short-lived at best. Because even if people didn't change their minds, their minds will be changed for them in time because of illnesses, financial losses, children, other things that just sort of change people, change everything. So attraction is going to be gone at some point because we start to look older and we're not as attractive. At least our bodies are not as attractive for most of us as we get older. So what are we going to do about that? How long is it going to be that we're going to be thinking the same thing? How long is it going to take for us to disagree about things or to not want to do something at the same time? Gee, we, in courtship, we wanted to do this always, but now I'm not in the mood. I don't want to do that. The chances of us agreeing on doing the same thing or wanting to do the same thing at the same time are almost nil.
Okay, so sorry to in this sample at such a negative place, but he does go on to talk about how you can deal with that situation and end up in a much more solid place. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one's not to your taste, they've got over 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Jerry Trumbull, continuing my inner space explorations in Denver, Colorado, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Longtime listeners will recognize the voice of my old friend, Jerry Trumbull, who was a frequent guest and advisor in earlier episodes. I hope to get him back before too long. I'll read two of our recent emails from our listener community today. First, we hear from listener and donor Charles, who in part writes, "I'm glad I made the donation. The content of the show informs my practice, my teaching, and usually dictates the next book I decide to read. Plus, you do such an awesome job of just being a warm and authentic presence during the interviews. You've got such a wealth of knowledge. I think it really makes things flow. And again, that's from Charles, who teaches social work. And so, Charles, I thank you very much for that and for getting your students involved as well. Next, we hear from Selena, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thanks so much for the wonderful work you do with Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm a longtime listener, and I absolutely love your program, and I look forward to listening to it each week. I contribute a small amount to your program each month and have also transcribed a past show, something I enjoyed doing immensely. I recently listened to your 1022 interview with Suzanne Maiden, and her work is particularly resonant for me at this time. I was wondering if you could help me out. I would very much like to get in touch with her. Upon viewing her website and trying to contact her through her email listed, things have bounced back to me, and it's stated that her email is not in use. If it is appropriate, could you put me in touch with her, either giving her my contact information and asking if she would be willing to contact me, or by giving me her contact info if you feel that's appropriate? In a nutshell, I have never, ever been drawn to the idea of an afterlife and have always considered myself a devout atheist. However, almost a month ago, on 10/3/15, I lost my life partner and father to my daughter in a bicycle accident, actually in your neck of the woods, in the Gran Fondo race in Santa Rosa. My life partner, Edward, was a competitive, highly competent cyclist who died instantly in the accident, the only one of its kind in the race's history." And she goes on to provide a link to the newspaper article from the Press Democrat. "Oddly enough, because Edward's unexpected absence from our life as we know it and emotional devastation it has caused me and my daughter, I find myself suddenly desperately drawn to the idea of contacting the afterlife, if there is such a thing. And hearing your interview with Suzanne Maiden when I did was very timely. Some part of myself, despite my skepticism, can't help but wonder about the timing of this episode. It, plus some other synchronistic events, like several people reaching out to me with medium-like communication with Edward during the same time frame, has opened me up in a way I never have been opened before. I realize I'm quite vulnerable during this acute window of grief and despair, so I'm purposely avoiding buying any snake oil at this time. However, Suzanne's sanity and your reference to knowing her for such a long time gave me confidence in her as a practitioner and quite possibly in her medium abilities. Thank you in advance. I would greatly appreciate it if there is any way you can put me in touch with Suzanne. Sincerely, Selena." And I read that with Selena's permission, by the way. Selena Mitchell, who is also a licensed acupuncturist and has a Master of Science degree as well. And Selena, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. Yes, you're right about that bicycle race being in my neck of the woods. And actually, I read about your husband's accident in our local newspaper right after it happened. I'm glad that you experienced a ray of light in the interview with Suzanne Maiden. And I will put you in touch with her in the hope that it will help you in your recovery from this tragedy. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using the app, which you can get information about on our site, or on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, couples therapist Marnie Feuerman, for generously sharing her insights and practices. My next guest will be psychoanalyst Dr. Leon Hoffman, and we'll be discussing the recent anniversary of Sigmund Freud's seminal work, The Interpretation of Dreams. This interview will be quite a bit shorter than recent ones due to the pressures of Dr. Hoffman's schedule. But I hope you'll join us. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.